Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. This is David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Dr. Rob Lamberts, a primary care physician, or as he sometimes says, a recovering doctor, who recently celebrated 5 years of no longer accepting payment from health insurance companies. After nearly 20 years in a traditional practice and developing a national reputation as an expert on electronic health records, he has shifted course and has a direct primary care practice. He still seems to have a thing for llamas, though nobody knows why. You can find Rob on Twitter at DocRob, that's at DOC_ROB. His blog is titled Musings of a Distractible Mind, which you can find at more-distractible.org. And I just want to mention that while we have never met in real life, or IRL as the kids would have it, I got to know Rob through his blog and through the late lamented Grand Rounds blog carnival, which we both participated in for a number of years. We both still blog, but thanks to the decline in the attention span of the reading public, we now do radio shows and podcasts. Well, welcome, Rob, and thanks for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, David. And yeah, again, I feel like we've known each other for quite a while, having never met each other.
Yes, it's amazing. I always tell my kids that they shouldn't connect with anyone online who they don't know in real life. And the response I've always gotten for years has been, but Dad. Anything I missed? Anything you'd like to add to the introduction, Rob, before we get started?
No, that introduction was wonderful. I mean, it's great. It hit all the important points.
Okay. So I live in Boston, and the streets around here are basically paved cow paths. They make no sense, and certainly no sense to me, having grown up in Manhattan. You've written over the years about how imposing an EHR on top of a broken system, or using an EHR to check a box for some other regulatory scheme, is, not to put too fine a point on it, a complete waste of time and effort. Could you expand on that thinking? Sort of what is the problem with either the use of the records, their design, or the way they're implemented? And maybe that's an entree into a broader discussion.
Well, sure. I first grew interested in electronic health records in my residency program, Indiana University, where the Regan Streiff Clinic, I mean, our records were computerized already, and this was, it was between 90 and 94, so, but it was incredible how much easier it was to use the computers to do order entry, to do all this stuff. And so when I got into private practice in 94, I was just convinced that we needed to go to computers. And the reason I was convinced was that I felt like I couldn't do as good of a job as I wanted to do just using a paper chart. Like, you know, answering the question, when was this person's last colonoscopy? Or what antibiotics have they been on? Or, you know, just asking questions that are clinically relevant at the time of the office visit. And, you know, when I'm seeing the patient, so that I don't have to search around for information. And so, you know, from my standpoint, it was the idea of going into doing computerized medical records was one of the idea was to improve the quality of the care I was giving. And so we started on electronic medical records back in 96 or 97. It was between those. We did MedicalLogic, which turned into GE Centricity. And we adopted it, but our idea of adoption wasn't one of saying, well, how can we fit our care to this health record? It was the opposite. It was, okay, so we actually kind of said, well, we like this about this health record system, and this part we don't like at all. So let's make it work so that I can see my patients more efficiently, so that I can have better information and give better quality care. And that sort of attitude actually buoyed me to the top within the GE, well, the MedicalLogic group, because we were using the system far more robustly than most people were, because again, they were feeling constrained by the record system. I actually became part of, you know, of their user group, president of their user group and such, and was on their board of their user group for a long time, and really felt like I had some influence on what the product looked like. And I hope your users don't want to shoot me at this point in time, or your listeners. But the truth is that all changed when the whole government intrusion, when meaningful use came along, and you know, after that, the all of those data submission and pay for performance type of measures, it totally got subverted. The electronic medical record became totally subverted by the healthcare system. And so, you know, I would say that it is possible to have electronic records be something that actually work even in a broken system, because yeah, we made it work for a long time. I mean, our practice actually won the Hims-Davies Award in, I think it was 2003, or I forget, it was a long time ago. So we won the Davies Award for implementation of electronic medical records in a ambulatory care setting. And so obviously we're doing things right. We were profitable as a practice. It wasn't smoke and mirrors. We were really making it work. We were not, you know, it was a private practice. It wasn't funded by the hospital or anything like that. But there was a huge shift when all of these certifications came and when, you know, the meaningful use came. And honestly, I first thought those were a good thing. But as time went by, I began to see, instead of becoming devices to make things more efficient, computers became devices that would enable over-documentation, data submission, to a degree that totally departed from clinical care. And that to me became where everything fell apart within the electronic health record community.
So what you're saying is very interesting, because it's a little different from the typical narrative that I hear when people are railing against electronic health records and saying, oh, this was just built as a claims capture tool and not as a clinical tool at all. What I hear you saying is that, however it may have been designed initially, you and your group were able to take it and mold it to your will and use it in a way that was helpful to your practice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the things went off the rails with the meaningful use and other regulatory intrusions into the system.
Yeah, the more that the billing side of things became tied to the electronic record, the more perverted the whole system became, or just it got perverted away from this being a clinical record. And I just remember at one point in time, they did a new release, and it was like everything had a few more steps to it. And I was like, wait a minute. This is supposed to, your newest release is supposed to make things easier, not harder. And it turns out that it was actually getting harder and harder for us to do, because you had more data submission to be able to qualify for meaningful use, to be able to qualify for NCQA certification, to be able to qualify for whatever types of things that you were looking for. As these things came up, the billing side of things grew in importance and totally took over the record system. So again, I remember back in the day when it was a novelty to have a computerized medical record. And so we could kind of do whatever we wanted and just essentially make it a tool for efficiency, which is what computers do well.
So you've taken a significant turn off the path, so to speak, both right. In terms of technology and in terms of the structure of your practice. I'd like to ask you to describe your direct primary care practice, how that differs from a traditional physician practice, as most of us are familiar with.
Yeah, well, it was 5 years ago, and I was, there were a bunch of reasons why I just kind of couldn't continue to practice in my practice that I'd been in for 18 years. So we had kind of a divorce, as it were, as far as partners go. And I had the decision on what I was going to do. And really didn't want to go into more of the hamster wheel of primary care with all of the certification and all the stuff I had been in, because I was really feeling like I was getting burned out. And so I ended up talking to Dave Chase. I think you probably know Dave.
Sure.
He, you know, he's kind of a thought leader in a lot of areas in healthcare, and he was a real proponent of direct primary care. I think he knew the folks out in Seattle. He described direct primary care, and really essentially there are two things that differentiate direct primary care from regular practice. One is that you take no money from insurance companies and you're paid instead by your patients directly. Some of the concierge practices out there will do a monthly fee, but that's kind of for services that are non-covered services, but then they still do bill for the typical, you know, E&M 99214 visits or whatever, so that you're getting all the money from that. On top of that, you're getting a monthly fee. Direct care says, nah, we're just going to bill the patients for their care. The other important cornerstone of direct primary care is that it's a monthly payment is the central way of paying. And what those do is they totally change the way that I practice, in the sense that I don't have to keep my office full of patients, because I'm paid just as much when they're full and when they're not, when it's full and when it's not. So I bring people in when they need care in my office, but if they can get care outside of my office, it doesn't hurt me financially to do so. And so, you know, in a typical practice, if a patient sends you a phone, you know, calls you up and says, hey, you know, what about this bladder infection that I get? Well, if you treat it, then you're losing money. You're giving away care for free. From the business standpoint, it's bad to do any care that doesn't force the patient to come into the office, as opposed to in my practice, where it's actually better for me to handle things outside of the office if I can. And you know, right before I left my old practice, I did a head count and said, you know, what percentage of my visits actually require the patient to be here? And the what I came up with is about 25%. And that's borne out for what I do now, where a certain percentage of my visits are in the office, but well over two or maybe three times that number of virtual visits are done during the day. So I answer questions via text message or via phone or, you know, whatever works. We just kind of try and give as good a care as we can. And that just totally transformed also the idea of record keeping, because since I'm no longer caring about, you know, I don't have to chart for billing, I actually had to stop and ask myself the question of what would a medical record look like if the only thing it was for is actually patient care.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Dr. Rob Lamberts. We're talking now about the uses of electronic health records in a direct primary care practice.
So I'm in this direct primary care practice where I don't have to worry about third-party payers. I don't have to worry about my notes complying with E&M coding. I don't even need to worry about CPT and ICD-9 coding at all, because I'm billing on a monthly basis and I'm being paid by my patients, not the third party payers. And I was just thinking, what does my medical record actually look like if it's just about patient care? And that actually, when I started 5 years ago, direct primary care, it really has evolved in the past 5 years to become something that has a significant footprint on the medical landscape at this point in time and is growing. There were under 100 practices when I started 5 years ago. Now there's nearly 1,000 or over 1,000. I guess it depends who you talk to, but it's growing rapidly. But at that point in time, I hated everything that I looked at, because they all centered around billing. So how do I get them to do what I want to. I actually ended up making my own medical record from a database. Took a ton of work, but it was a good way to learn. I used a FileMaker Pro database on my Mac and built a very workable medical record system and used it for about 2 years. And then finally, the EHR products out there caught up, and there were several now. There are several now that actually focus on direct primary care because we've got enough doctors to support them. So about a year and a half ago, I switched off of my old system just because it was so much work to maintain. So now I use Elation, actually is the one that I use, but it's hooked into my messaging system, which is a secure direct messaging system with the patients. It hooks in with my monthly billing software, and it's this interconnected idea. It's kind of a communications hub is really the whole idea, that communication is in the center of healthcare, whether it is in the office, which is just a different form of communication, or if we do it via text message or virtual visits or whatever. I mean, we have all sorts of options on how to give care.
Makes a lot of sense to mm-hmm. sort of choose the way in which the patient wants to receive or send communications, what makes sense for you, what makes sense for the patient, what makes mm-hmm. sense for the particular situation, rather than, as you said, being sort of tied to the notion of the office visit as the requirement. Are there other kinds of tools or services that you use? How do you communicate with your patients' specialists, for example, or how do their hospitals communicate with you?
Well, unfortunately, specialists are still faxing me stuff, and I'm still having to. That cutting edge technology. cutting edge faxing technology is right out there. Only health. Well, I think law. They do a lot of faxing still, but everybody else has kind of moved on, and it is very hard to drag people into the 21st century and say, look, we do have secure communication. That's a lot easier. So I don't have that much interaction with specialists that way. I keep trying to do things, but the nice thing is that I can focus on that communication. And whereas in the past where I would send a consult and not have a lot of clinical background, now I make sure that there's a ton of clinical background. So when I send that person to ENT, they have a well-documented reason. They know why they're seeing this person rather than just saying, okay, having the patient explain it to them. So, that's one of the nice features of my electronic health system. It's a very nice referral a module that allows me to refer patients and attach documents. And it gets faxed, which stinks, but they have the option of actually logging on and seeing stuff. And there are a few folks who will log on and look at stuff securely.
Okay. So we've been talking about sort of both looking backward and looking forward in terms of the uses of technology. And I know you've thought a lot about this over the years. Do you see near-term evolution of artificial intelligence or machine learning or whatever the buzzword du jour is in that realm? Do you see those tools becoming useful in clinical practice in the near term?
I hope so. Interestingly, my son is a graduate of Georgia Tech, and he's actually doing his master's degree at Georgia Tech in computer science, focusing on machine learning and artificial intelligence. So it's like, wow, perfect. And he and I started talking about 2 or 3 months ago about how this could potentially apply to direct primary care. And, at first, I think it would just be, and honestly, he got really excited, and we're actually talking about maybe even making a little business out of it, and it would be a lot of fun to do it with my son. But anyway, the idea would be at first just to make sure that the record was accurate, make sure that the medicines are getting checked, and if they haven't been checked in a certain amount of time, or if certain data is not there, send a message, a secure message out to the patient, get that information back, and put it in. But eventually to start recognizing things like, you know, this person came in with this symptom and he's on this medicine or she's on this medicine that could potentially cause that, and alerting the doctor to that. Or, you know, for the doctor to easily be able to say, you know, what are the different antibiotics have they been on, and be able to look down and see that very quickly and easily. The idea would be for that to eventually evolve into something where it is actually starting to recognize patterns of how the patient is doing afterwards. And I think artificial intelligence, one of the things that I'm convinced is going to be the last thing that AI or computers can do. And honestly, it's something that I think a lot of doctors have kind of forgotten how to do because of the computers, is how to take a narrative from the patient. How to say, okay, tell me what's going on, explain to me what's going on, and hearing the narrative of their illness and asking the right questions and putting things together as you're talking to them. That's a skill of a good diagnostician. And, you know, unfortunately, the boilerplates from electronic medical records have pushed a lot of that aside. But to me, it's the most human part of our care. And it's the part that, you know, my patients love the fact that I'm spending, instead of spending 50% of my time with the computer, I'm spending about 10% of my time with the computer, and most of my time is spent talking to them. And I think it greatly improves the quality of our care. So I think taking that information, I don't think the computer will do that well. That's the last thing we ever need the computers to do. All of the other stuff, though, is being able to say, so wait a minute, you're due for a colonoscopy, or, you know, wait a minute, that you came in with this symptom and you've had it three other times in the past. That's the kind of thing a computer could pick up much quicker than a person, and you could use that information, could enhance the quality of care. So I really do believe that overall the quality of care could greatly improve with just more accurate information, with just better organization of that information, so that you can retrieve stuff. And as time goes by, it can start saying, you know, past four times you prescribed this medicine, here was the outcome. It can start educating the doctor in the things that we don't ever see. You know, how does it turn out in the end? A lot of times it's just kind of this void that patients go out into when you're doing certain treatments. And I really do think a computerized system that maybe a week or two after the visit sends them saying, so tell me how you're doing, and have the patients reply to that and have the computer start to gather that information and learn from it. That'd be really cool.
That does sound cool. And that sort of prefigures what I'd like to ask as my last question, and maybe you have something more to say along these lines. If you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what is one thing in healthcare that you would hope, or maybe even expect, to be radically different?
First thing I would hope is that this business model that I'm in will have evolved and become a very significant force within the system. One of the reasons I like direct primary care is that I am only working for the patient. I'm not trying to get more money out of insurance companies. I'm not trying to increase the bottom line of the hospital. And I see that as kind of like playing defense for the sake of the patient, to spend less money, to do less medications, to push back. You know, I think there's a misconception that people want more care. The majority of my patients would rather not get surgery, would rather not have procedures done, rather not take an antibiotic. They understand that. And with a little bit of education, they can understand it much quicker. And so I really would hope that healthcare will at least have a larger segment that is pushing back and saying, no, we don't need to spend this much money. Because that's really what's wrong with the healthcare system, is that we're spending too much money, and there's nobody who is standing in the way and saying that and saying, you know, we need to spend less, because nobody profits from that. But I do, because my patients love me, because I'm on their side. And so if I can do that more efficiently, I can grow my patient population and make more income. And overall, my business model pushes me towards doing things in a better way. The only other thing I would say is, I think we need to develop more stuff with genetics from a preventive standpoint. The idea that 5% of the population that's going to get 90% of the prostate cancer or whatever, 10% of the population, and then screen those people efficiently and effectively because their risk is a lot higher and screening's going to make a lot more sense. Or do the same thing with breast cancer, or do the same thing with, you know, whatever. You can even do it with rare cancers because it would be, you know, just this 0.1% of the population that is at high risk of pancreatic cancer. Well, we can identify that and then find some better screening modalities to prevent the cancer in the first place or detect it early. I think a lot of the emphasis on genetics is towards treatment. But I really think this idea of identifying risk and doing things either to reduce the risk or to mitigate the risk by doing early detection so that the risk would be, yeah, that they might get pancreatic cancer, but it's just a small nodule when they diagnose it and it's not metastasized all over the place. But I think that that's going to take a change in the overall mindset from a sick care system to a healthcare system. And I know that's cliche. But that's really what it needs to be. It needs to be focusing on keeping people well and away from hospitals and away from specialists and away from medications and away from chemotherapy.
Right. Well, that's a very positive vision for the future. Thank you, Rob, for taking the time. I appreciate it. It's been an interesting conversation. You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC on Twitter. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.